Welcome to Talking Up Music Education, a podcast from the NAMM Foundation. Talking Up Music Education podcast shares news and stories about music education from teachers, students, parents, school, and community leaders who care about music education and are working to create more opportunities for music learning. And now, here's your host, Mary Lurson.
Hi, good morning, everyone. This is Mary Lurson, Executive Director of the NAMM Foundation, here coming to you live via our friends at InterTalk Radio from the NAMM Show, Sunday morning at the NAMM Show, the very last day of the NAMM Show. So my voice is a little bit hoarse, and my energy is a little bit lower, but we've had a marvelous week here in Anaheim, and we're so grateful that you can join us. You could also hear us later at our podcast at Talking at Music Education, and we've been grateful to have about 6 or 8, 10, I've lost count, guests sit with us this week for our podcast. And this morning, I'm delighted to welcome Len Horwitz from
History of Recorded Sound in Culver City, California.
History of Recorded Sounds with an S.
Well, in Culver City. The website earned its S. We lost the other one.
Okay. We're so grateful to have you here, Len. And I was studying up a bit about your background. And you represent sort of a wonderful place where we are. I guess wonderful is a graded scale, depending on your point of view. But I think it's a wonderful place between the option to experience music in the analog style or the analog technology. Then, of course, we have all this miniaturization and digitization available to us as well. But you've really devoted your professional recording engineering career to analog and are really now restoring it and are considered one of our most important experts and knowledgeable people in the field. So how did it all start for you?
Well, the History of Recorded Sound actually started out as a class. I was asked to come into, it was the Columbia School of Broadcasting. It was right next to Channel 13 on La Brea. And some of the teachers would have a difficult time with a certain aspect of technology. Say, can you come in tonight and demonstrate something? Explain this a little bit better than I can. I'm having trouble with it. So we'd bring in demos of things to help young people learn about the technology of the time.
Mm-hmm. And the technology of the time was the?
Was analog at the
time. The 2-inch?
Well, 2-inch was part of it, but more rudimentary than that. How does radio work? How does video work? How does this happen that we're able to?
The physics of sound.
Sound and video, how does it explain it in simple terms? That's really what they wanted.
So you taught a class and how long?
I was there evenings and I was a consultant.
Were they producers or were they?
Well, anybody that wanted to go to Columbia Broadcasting, wanting to get into the business, would be at that school.
So then were you also doing freelance work as a recording engineer?
At that time, I was with the Westrex Corporation, which was we were the record division of Western Electric. That's what Westrex was.
And what decade are we in here, the 60s?
Well, we're in the 70s.
The
70s,
we're
in the late 70s.
Yeah. With analog, why does it continue to be important? I mean, we hear a lot of musicians now, especially in the last couple of years, coming around wanting to find an analog studio to record in and, you know, making sure that their sound is laid down that way.
What's the appeal? Well, the appeal actually goes back probably 100 years or more, but basically, great engineers have created beautiful sounding equipment, beautiful sounding amplifiers, tape machines. They hand wound transformers. They made certain types of tubes. All these things add up to make the equipment more of a musical instrument than just a calculator or a digital machine, something that actually has sound quality imparted at the last minute. You like a certain microphone, you like a certain speaker, you like a certain amplifier. They have qualities that were built in from the design and making the components.
You know, I've never heard it described that well. For me, something just hit, that they were designed as an extension of the musical instrument.
Right. And, you know, growing up in an era, picture these engineers growing up with acoustic phonographs, non-electric, making the transition to electric, then making the transition to electric plus other aspects of it, like digital, like other things. It's a transition. And always things get lost sometimes when you make transitions. There's no free lunch in this audio business. You take something out to get some advantage and something is lost with it. So there's a sweet spot of this equipment. And that post-World War II equipment hits the highest of technology in the design of tubes and resistors and transformers. I mean, they really had it down by then.
Was it because they were recording so much music live?
Until the tape recorder came in, everything had to be live.
Mm-hmm.
Records were live. There's no overdubbing, really.
Right.
Except for somebody like Les Paul, who deliberately set out to overdub on records.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much it was a live performance. And I think engineers and the audience were, they kind of knew what they wanted to hear. They had a sound in their head and had tried to give that to the consumer mm-hmm. as best they could.
So are we, what old is new again? I mean, are artists asking for that when they come into a studio?
One of the things the phonograph records did was they are a document of technology from acoustic to early electric to stereo to even CD4. These are transitions that the record has done. And so any person, young or old, can go back and find a Stones record, a serious music record, like a Red Seal classical Victor record. And hear that all these recordings have imparted technologies and imparted sounds that are part of the era. And they say, well, I want that sound. How do they get that sound? And it's complicated.
And what do you do when someone wants that sound?
You educate them. That's what history record sound does.
Right. All right. So we're in a good place here. So yeah. So once you educate them, and then they look for a place where they can have that recording experience?
Yeah. We can do it within limits. It's a small place, but they can understand microphones, microphone placement, how the electronics affect sound, how the room affects. And believe me, the room, most people don't talk about the room as part of technology, but believe me, it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a space that doesn't sound very good, no amount of microphones, equalization, or technology is going to fix it.
So tell us about some of the people that you've worked with, be it producers or artists that have sought you out and have looked for a way to, I'm not happy with what I'm getting with the technology.
Well, most of the people that seek us out are not the artists and producers, but mastering studios, recording studios that are having a problem getting a certain technology to work or getting a certain sound. And we have to go back and take a look at what they want, what's wrong with it, what's right with it. One of our big time-consuming energies is the Ampex tape recorders by the dozen. And young people want to get into those things, but they are not easily used or understood by new aficionados of hi-fi or recording. They're crude. You have to be a pinball wizard with them. They don't run themselves. So that's an education process.
Yeah.
The electronics are an education process. Maintaining a tape machine is a process. And back in the day, the studios had people there handling just those machines day and night. They had service technicians and engineers just to make sure that the recording machines were calibrated. Digital, you don't have that problem anymore. It either works or it doesn't. There's no frequency setup. There's no wow and flutter setup. Nothing that you have to do with the equipment itself, but use it.
And yet all the requirements of the analog, you know, I know the what you get, what you give, the balancing, all the required sort of tinkering, right?
Yeah, well,
produces something really, really special.
Right, and if you read some of the books on the Beatles, Rolling Stones, there's always a section in there on how they wrapped tape on a capstan to change the pitch, or they fudged the knob curve to get a certain sound in the mid-range, or they would change some of the electronics to deliberately distort a certain way. Overloading tape is a topic that comes up over and over again. So everybody had an idea on how to use this stuff, and do it their own way, and that's part of the magic.
That's part of the magic. That's so interesting. So your place now, the history of recorded sound in Culver City, sounds to me like it's a sort of a workshop kind of setting. Museum,
oh, yeah, definitely.
Lesson, workshop, place to come in, work with you, folks come in, right. I've got this problem, I'm not getting by end result.
Well, one of the things we've done is we've actually educated and trained mastering engineers for the record product. Okay, that's, you can't get that too many places on earth right now. There's not a lot of apprenticeship places to learn how to master a good sounding record. So
when they're mastering onto vinyl.
Yeah, it's right. That's really an art.
Yeah, vinyl is just not another version of what's a digital recording.
No, it's mechanical, and you have to deal with mechanical things. Mm-hmm. And you have to learn what part you play in it, you know. So it's an interesting transition from digital to back to that.
Yeah. And what percentage of the recording industry is doing that?
More and more, I'm afraid. Although there's a very few mastering places, they all require trained engineers because, you know, this is a very expensive product, the record. It's the replication process is involved. And the master is the mold. Has to be perfect.
At the same time, I hope that what you have and your knowledge is in pretty high demand.
We get a lot of calls, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, on a daily basis, a lot of it has to do with the maintenance of equipment. Calls about, we have this problem, what do we do? Well, one of the major concerns about the record industry boils down to one thing, and that is the recording head that engraves and cuts the records. Now, there's two, maybe three people in the world that can service them, and we're one of those. So it's interesting how to carry that on so that the next generation can have these machines working well.
Yeah. Sounds like there's a proposal in there for an apprentice program or
definitely.
A whole new rash of recording engineers, young recording engineers, in search of that warm sound.
Yeah. Well, they are out there, and we hear about it.
Yeah.
Most of the questions that come up is, how did they get to that place? How did they get that sound? If we want it again, what do we do? And it's a complicated state of affairs.
So is some of this information and your knowledge base available at your website? And do you have you written some papers about all of these things? And can people tap into your remarkable knowledge
It's right now, it's basically one-on-one. A lot of it is difficult to write. It involves a hands-on kind of experience.
Yeah, because it's a mechanical thing that you're doing.
There are
right?
so many books out there on recording technology and record. When I talk to people about it, I always recommend Tremaine's book, The Audio Cyclopedia. Start with that. All your questions will be answered in one form or another. That's a good place to start.
Great recommendation, too. So I guess I'm going to go carefully into this question because I have such respect for your history and your knowledge. But is digital advancing in a way that we will maybe someday say, yes, it's not the same, but we're getting a fairly good audio experience from digital?
I think digital has to be accepted for what it is and its best use. Nobody years ago, say 20 years, maybe even less, 20 years ago, could take a song and get it around the world at the speed of light to every person on the planet if they want to hear it. That technology is the digital world of pure data. Once you take it to pure data, you now have a new power. And anybody with a telephone can do it. That's new. That's an important thing to be able to do. And the picture as well. When we were growing up, it was a whole different way of dealing with it. You got in your Chrysler, you'd put on the AM radio, and there'd be the top 40. If you liked something, you pulled over to a record store, which was like a Starbucks. There's a record store on every corner. And for 65 cents, you bought that record. And that was a very democratic way to get it out there. And that's how it worked for years and years and years. It wasn't a bad way, but it wasn't the same way.
Right. Yeah. So what we've gained a lot.
You've gained a funny kind of distribution.
Right.
That's been a boon to young careers and people mm-hmm. getting discovered on YouTube and all
and
over.
And more people doing it.
More people doing it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the question or the funny thing is, how does the analog record survive amidst that? Well, you don't need it. I mean, you've got this marvelous way to get things out there. So what happens is why is it there? Is the question.
Well, I think we've described it earlier. There's a yearning for that purity,
yeah.
right? Of that niche,
yeah.
right? And it's become a niche in the industry that I don't think even that niche, you were maybe, you know, standing alone on a mountain for now. I said, I know a few more people that are in there,
well,
right, participating.
There's a funny thing that happened with the records that most people don't think about, but it lives more in the art world than the technical world. You can own it, you can open it, you can touch it, you can sell it, you can have it autographed. It's at least as big as your face. And young people like to own things. The CD was not a good archival product. Kids would carry them around in the backpacks, break the jewel cases,
yeah.
scratch the discs, and they really weren't perfect sound forever like advertised. You know, they were a little bit more fragile than that. So the art piece helped the survival of the record. And the fact that they were made in small quantities and did become destroyed, scratched, and disappeared only added to the value of it, didn't detract from it.
So I'm going to go back to a little bit of part of that question I just asked. On the digital side, I mean, we had this distribution revolution, but are we improving with the audio quality?
One of the things that happened is there was a bell curve to audio quality with digital. I think they've hit it for the amount of data they want to consume with the audio. The audio-only format in digital became more of a passive experience, and it led the way to larger video exploitation, higher definition screens, 5.1 sound, 3D. And most of the money, I think, in digital is spent in that arena rather than audio. I don't know that there's as much research.
It's very interesting.
As there was.
Yeah, and there's also not the demand for make it sound better. Right?
Well, this brings us back to history of recorded sound and teaching or helping young people listen to music again as an audio-only format. Is something that's a learned experience. It's not like nest building. You're not born with appreciating music and audio. I encourage everybody to get a piece of sheet music and even just follow the lyrics along to learn how the architecture of the song works, rhythm patterns, time signatures. It's the sheet music is kind of like the electrical schematic to a fine piece of audio equipment or any equipment, where you can see the genius of how it works.
Well, we're now speaking the same language here. It's the importance of music education, right?
Basically,
I mean, the elements of music. You know, there was a whole generation mm-hmm. that had that opportunity instead. It was ubiquitous in school. There wasn't we're going back 40 years, right? And every kid, you know, every classroom teacher had to play the piano.
Yeah,
you wouldn't be hired to
that's
be a classroom
right.
teacher unless you were proficient on the piano. You know, and that's just not a music specialist. That was just...
I'm old enough to remember that.
Yeah.
They were pretty good at it, actually.
Yeah, it was required.
Right.
You know, so you couldn't get your teaching normal degree or, it was just a different time. So, you know, what we work for at the NAMM Foundation is that learning of the musical elements. You talked about sheet music, you talk about the musical staff, the relationship of notes to, you know, meter and all these things. You know, I'm happy to say that things are looking better out there. But, you know, it's interesting, you know, you're having to promote that education in the middle of the sea of all this access. And you can go make beats and you can upload all this stuff without ever really having to know that. But we know that the people that do know that end up bringing more innovation and more insight into that production process.
It'll elevate the literacy level of the music and lyric writer and the audience.
Yeah, everybody.
I lived in a funny time. That period between 1964 and 70 was an unusual time because you had these very serious poets, which were fine writers crafting songs that have withstood the test of time to transcend generations. You know, if you think about it, a young person today, they wouldn't know Burt Williams, for example, maybe, or they wouldn't know even Al Jolson, maybe, or listen to a record that's 100 years old, but they sure enjoy a record that's 50 years old or 40 years old. In other words, there's something that happened in that time with the technology, the music, and the literacy of the audience that made it possible.
The beat poets, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot going on there in society in general.
And the music was for a college crowd. I mean, the writers, Simon and Garfunkel and Laura Nero and Bob Dylan, they were writing a certain way for a certain literacy level of their audience.
Yeah, we can back into all sorts of statements about, you know, it was in the 60s that the youth culture emerged because the middle class finally stabilized post-war and there was discretionary funding in families and there was enough money for a kid to say, hey, Dad, I need a buck for a record.
There were more turntables in homes and toilets.
I mean, there was, you know, we look at the whole package, right, of societal change and middle class arising post-war. You're taking me right back to my music history classes. So I want to ask you to do one thing for me.
Sure.
Say a phrase that has audio terminology in that I would absolutely be clueless what it meant.
Oh, my God.
Give me one phrase of audio technology that you know precisely what it means, but I would have to say it's time out. What does it mean?
All right, well, you can talk about vacuum tube transconductance, things like that.
Okay, number one, vacuum tube. Okay. I kind of know what a vacuum tube is.
Right.
Transconductance, now I could deduce that by something is moving, but when you say trans, it's moving differently.
Well, we're talking about the gain.
Now we're into gain.
Okay. There's recording curves like the NAB curve, RIAA curve, things like that.
This is fun. Keep going.
Okay. The listeners are not going to be bored.
Oh, no, we're having fun. They're going, look, they're being really wonky about this. This is great.
There's bias oscillator coupling.
I'm totally gone. Anybody else? Yeah. Bias oscillator coupling. Mm-hmm.
Well, those are just the tip of the iceberg, I'm afraid.
I'm just teasing you a little bit, you know, with respect for what you know.
Yeah.
And for respect for so much of what the folks in our industry know and bring to the table.
Yeah. And I got to be honest with you. I had an opportunity to learn from the best of them because John Frayne was still alive. He was the president of ERPI, which was the engineering arm of Bell Labs. John Jarvis, Keith Johnson, they were all alumni from at Western Electric.
Yeah,
Westrex Corporation.
And did you have a higher education? Did you go to college for this? Where was your college experience?
I went to Northridge University. I was in the English and Motion Picture Department. I had no idea I was going to get this involved with it at the time. Not that early on. But I just started hearing recordings change, the quality changed. I didn't like it. I was disappointed in the mid-70s and on what was happening, and started to look at the equipment and how it was being used and realized that maybe some of those things need to be put back, some of the things from the earlier time.
You know, we have a big community that we support and we help and we nurture. It's our college music students. And I would just want to make sure to share your resource with them because there's a lot of these young people are coming through now.
Yeah, we welcome it.
Yeah. So to find you, you're at History of Recorded Sounds with an S.com.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's where folks can find. Uh-huh. And when we go out there with our podcast info, we'll be sure to include
that. That's good. And we'll welcome anybody that is a serious desire to learn about it. And that helps.
Yeah.
That'll help the future of it, actually, in a fun way.
Well, thank you for all that you're doing for the recorded industry community, for all of us at NAMM. I think it's a great privilege for us to sit with you today.
And I want to thank my nephew, Jacob Horowitz, for bringing me, who works with me,
yeah,
and his friend, Barbara.
we might have a chance for the next generation to do this meticulous.
Well, they've embraced it, so yeah. I guess it's...
Well, what more can we ask for, right?
Well, I really appreciate being here.
Yeah, thank you so much. I've been so delighted to have this conversation with Len Horowitz. I understand almost everything that he said, but we had a fun time teasing him a little bit about the language of the recording industry that is important to the beautiful musical products and musical sounds that we experience in our lives. So thank you for all that you've done.
One thing comes up is, do you have any money? That's a phrase we hear a lot, too.
Right. Do you have, yeah. Well, we hear that a lot, too. Yeah. All right. So now we're back on the same page. Yeah. So, but thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us here live from the NAMM Show, our last day of the 2019 NAMM Show. We hope you have a great time out there.
Thank you very much.
You'll be kicking a lot of pro audio company, the tires of those companies that are out there. And thanks for joining us, Talking at Music Education, a podcast of the NAMM Foundation.
Talking Up Music Education is a podcast created by the NAMM Foundation. To learn more about how you can support music education in your community or how you can be part of the work of the NAMM Foundation, visit our website, www.namfoundation.org, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/NAMM Foundation. You can also follow Mary on Twitter at Mary L. NAMM. That's Mary L. N-A-M-M.